This is CliffCentral.com.
Isn't that happy? That's such a happy song. Leanne was saying that the music in the 80s, they were just making happy music. It was because of the drugs, really, that they were so happy.
But they were just so happy. They weren't
drugs
like,
and money and women. And
there was no angst or moodiness.
No one was phoning them up from a PR department of a major social media network or you know, someone who wanted to sponsor them, because everybody wanted to sponsor them, and saying, what is your position, though, on trans rights? We need to know what your position is on trans rights. If you asked Daryl Hall back in the 1980s, like, what was your position on trans rights, he'd say, I don't even know what that is. I'm sorry, I can't hear you over the sound of my Gulfstream jet engines as I take off for another concert in Florida.
And they didn't have to Instagram everything they were doing.
Yeah, John Oates saying, I'm thinking of wearing this T-shirt tonight at the concert, but maybe people won't like it and they'll somehow find a way to tell me that.
Yeah, because red's a threatening color.
Let's do an Instagram poll to my fans on what T-shirt I should wear.
No. Just go on stage, and if they don't like you, they
Oh, no. I don't have the free trade cotton shirt today.
Oh, this was made by small hands of tiny children in, you know, Islamabad. What am I going to do to explain this to my critics and social media? None of that happened.
So, of course, I was away last week, but well done, Gareth, on winning the bachelor pool.
Yes. It's worth just referring to this very briefly.
Your team of jizzers,
they've really delivered. It's basically down to two girls, as I understand it, because I really only watched the first episode.
As I understand it, there are girls involved and some guy.
As I understand it, there are two girls left, Gina and Jazan, both of whom are on my list. So Leanne and Ben and Sia all owe me $100.
Indeed.
But I'll, for the fun of it, let you keep your money if you get it right on this one.
Uh-huh.
Or double it if I get it right. I get to choose which one I'm going to go with, though.
I think he picks Jazan.
Yeah, now, you see, I have to excuse myself from this now, because I actually know who wins.
You know who wins? Oh, you've right.
Been, no, hold on. Let me correct people. That. No,
how long have you known?
No, let me correct
how
that.
How long have you known?
I don't know, but I know a person who knows.
Uh-oh.
So, who's and told I've, you? I know I've said to them, don't. But at any point, I can ask.
All right, so you're going to...
Stop lying. You have asked.
I swear to God.
You threatened this person, just like at time you threatened Sia about the Prism Awards.
So you're going to throw in your $100 anyway. You've lost.
That's true, Okay.
You're not going to go for a double or nothing.
I'm recusing myself.
Okay, but we still want your $100.
Okay, fair.
Sia's going to pay in his $100. He was ready to hand it over on Friday already. But Ben, you might want to do a double here. You're going to go with Jazan? Because I'm happy to go with Gina.
Well, it's more exciting. Of course I've got to take that action.
Right, so I'm taking Leanne's money anyway, and Sia's. So I'm going to get $200.
Yeah.
I'll take that $200, and I'll say, Ben, you can cancel your debt to me.
Or give me $200.
Like the Lannisters would say.
Yeah.
Or you have to give me $200.
Gareth, I'll take that action all day. Okay. Look, it's obvious he's going to take Shazam.
I'm going with Gina.
Because she's taller.
I don't know about that. I think that Jazan is quite hard work. I think that Gina's probably a little more media savvy. There's potential there for a relationship, even if it's a relationship mutual benefit. I see something happening. I think
also,
so.
Also, not all men like tall women, do they?
Yeah, some men like them really dumpy and short. Like
Gina's not dumpy.
I'm not saying Gina is. I'm saying there are girls who find boyfriends and they could run under tables without bending their knees. Every pot has a lid. But I will tell you that I think that Gina and Lee are probably a good match. I'm gonna take that bet with Ben. All right, so Ben, there's still some skin in the game for you and me.
Ben, right. You're back in.
Done.
After leaving right in the beginning.
Yeah, I know. I had such a great list all out. And also, I'm trying to watch the show, but it's so bad. Basically, I have it on the background and I just watch the end.
I see that Bachelor USA is finally on. I mean, I've tried to avoid spoilers on social media, but it's been really difficult. I've kind of seen what color hair the winner has, and that's about it. But now I'm going to start watching The Proper Bachelor.
Here's Carl, who says, now that it's come to the end of The Bachelor and you've done your weekly update, it's given us a chance to realize that still nobody gives a fuck. I cannot wait until it's over.
Yes. Right,
there we go.
We know.
Positive feedback from Carl. All right, let's talk about some of the things in the news. This is a horrifying story, and I want to start with it because it's happened on our doorstep. Kempton Park, which, of course, you know, it's not the greatest neighborhood in Joburg. I mean, I don't have to put kid gloves on when I say this, but Kempton Park can be dodgy as hell. I've met a couple of people from Kempton Park. Out of the three people I know from Kempton Park, one of them is very nice. That's all I'll say.
So two aren't.
Well, I didn't
you
say
didn't
that,
say yeah. that, though.
Jesus. All right, so what happened?
Yeah, Ekurhuleni, right on everyone's doorstep who lives in Gauteng. Look east and you'll find it. Neighbors of the house where this incident occurred heard screams and commotions coming from the flat next door.
Usually not a good sign.
No. So they notified the police the day after because they realized something had gone terribly wrong.
Right.
Because the person who they thought was screaming turned out to be dead.
Oh, my God.
So neighbors were worried. They phoned the cops. They said, we haven't seen the girlfriend of the guy who lives next door to us since Thursday night.
Oh, yeah, yeah,
and this was on the weekend. So the cops pitched up, went to go and investigate. They started looking around the house, opened up the fridge.
Oh, no, you're joking.
And inside was the girlfriend's head and body stuffed into the fridge.
Oh, my God. Oh, my God. Oh, my God.
I don't
oh
think
God.
It would have had a chance to have frozen already.
No, it's probably still, yeah. Oh, my God, that's horrible.
Ooh, so he was arrested on Friday. He's expected to appear in the Kempton Park Magistrates Court today. The motive behind the murder is not yet known. But yes, one 23-year-old girl has been beheaded by her 31-year-old boyfriend.
Oh, my God. I've always said this, and I hate to gild the lily on this one, but, you know, the most dangerous people in your life are the people who you know and who know you.
Also,
it's
what's
not
the
these opportunist killers who are walking down the street. You know, see, always goes on about the killer.
Yes.
He could be there. The killer could be the person who you think loves you.
Also, one needs to know what was the rationale behind beheading her and putting her in the fridge.
I don't know if there's very much rationality that happens after that. You've killed someone and you need to do something. You think, well, what's the can't exactly throw them out with the rest of the rubbish.
Yeah, you watch a couple of movies and suddenly you think you know what you're doing. But
oh, it's terrible.
But all it takes is for the cops to open the fridge.
But like if you Google Kempton Park now, basically this is the story that comes up.
Oh, God,
yeah.
Really?
That's
the
horrible.
First thing that comes up?
Yeah.
God, how awful. Well, I'm sorry, Kempton Park. It's going to be a while before you can rehabilitate your reputation. And obviously, I feel sorry for the family of this girl, but what a story. My God.
Yikes.
Another horrible story. 20 Indian students have committed suicide after they got bad exam results. Now, I'm always one for accountability. You know, if you do well, own it. You've worked hard for that. If you do badly, own it. It's your fault. It's not the system. It's not people conspiring against you. It isn't your wicked teachers. If you failed, it's your fault. But Jesus, I mean, calm down. It doesn't need to mean you need to kill yourself.
Here's the even sadder part of the story.
Wow.
Is that as news is coming forward about these students committing suicide, news is also emerging that there are discrepancies in the results.
Oh, really? So they might have passed?
Yeah. So nearly a million students took the exams between February and March, and nearly 350,000 failed. It caused widespread protests from parents, student groups, and political parties.
Sure.
One student named Sirisha was failing biology. She set herself on fire at her home.
Oh, my God.
After her parents went out into the fields. Look, this is a country where just recently an Indian voter chopped off his finger after accidentally voting for the wrong party. So there is a bit of
funny.
A lot of dramatic stuff going on, you know.
Well, look at the movies.
Yeah. But yeah, it's now emerging that there could have been a technical glitch with the results of this test. Part of an error, part of the software solutions which are provided by an Indian company. These software packages process admissions, pre-examination, and post-examination results, and it's now coming out that they may have had a glitch. So 50,000 students who passed and also applied for re-verification, they weren't satisfied with their results. So even if the students did really well, they thought they should have done better.
Well, you see, it's so competitive also in India. You know, if you don't get in the top percentile, you just basically don't have a job.
That's it, yeah. It's really serious. Oish. And especially if you come from an impoverished family and they're relying on you to do really well.
But like, there's a lot of cases where Indian parents are very like domineering or overbearing like that. Yeah. There's the whole beauty pageant industry as well. Like, it's terrible. Like, his kids are getting sold off at like a young age, and like a lot of these parents are very pushy towards that kind of stuff.
Mm-hmm.
This is one of the most horrible documentaries I've seen around that.
These parents can benefit off of their children.
Horrible.
So student groups have now asked for the equivalent of $36,000, that's 25 lakh, as compensation for the families of each student who committed suicide.
You know, I hate it when people ask the government to pay out for the death of someone. I mean, it always to me just seems so cheap. And I mean, I get that people need money. Everyone needs money. If you got paid every time someone died, you know, you'd be rich. Everyone would be rich, but it doesn't bring that person back. And to me, it's a very impoverished way of thinking about replacing a person with money. It's just awful. I find it so distasteful. But while we're on education, William Smith got the Order of Ikhamanga, I think, or the Baobab, I can't remember, last week. And William Smith, of course, that teacher from TV that everybody remembers. Well, he's asking a question. Maybe you agree with him. That maybe the syllabus at schools is just in desperate need of revision. He says some of the things that we are taught will be of little use in the near future.
A lot of the stuff that we teach, I don't know what the pupils are going to do with it later on in life. I would tend to come back a bit and say, let's look at what we're going to use. For example, tables in arithmetic are crucial, absolutely crucial. You must know that 9/8 are 72. You mustn't think about it. Do we need quadratic equations? I'm not saying we don't. I'm just asking the question. Do we need that? Do we need, and now this is also controversial, do we need Shakespeare? What is Shakespeare going to do for the average person in a career? How many of your listeners who are adults have actually used Shakespeare to advantage? They've used tables. They've used arithmetic. But have they used quadratics? I don't know. Sometimes I get the feeling that we teach subjects for the sake of the subject rather than for the sake of the pupil.
Well, there used to be this thing called classical education where you would have to learn, you know, about history, and you'd have to learn about language, and you'd have to learn about philosophy. And these things prepared a young man or woman for the world because it gave them some exposure to the greatest ideas humanity's come up with.
Mm.
And among the greatest ideas that humanity's come up with are things like Shakespeare. The reason that Shakespeare is eternal and that it continues to be performed all over the world and that people in schools are forced to read it, sometimes against their will. I mean, I didn't love Shakespeare at school, I won't lie. But William Smith asks, when last did you use Shakespeare? I use Shakespeare regularly. I often refer to a character from Shakespeare, whether it's Iago from
Othello.
Yes, it's Othello. Correct. I was going to say The Merchant of Venice, but you're right. Othello. Iago, the bad guy, right? I often refer to his character when I'm in conversation with people. I'll talk to people and quote something from King Lear. I'll refer regularly to, like, Romeo and Juliet as this star-crossed pair of lovers. It becomes a reference point for language that allows you to condense big ideas into a reference.
Yeah.
You can say Macbeth and people know, oh, a murderer who tries to get the stain of murder off his hands. Someone who's overwhelmed and corrupted by the practice of one act.
Yeah.
You don't need to go into detail, but unless you know who Macbeth is, that means nothing to you. Then you're ignorant. And in conversation, I think Shakespeare is massively important. I also think philosophy is important. I think history is massively important. And when it comes to quadratic equations, I think that stuff teaches you logic. A lot of people don't have logic.
Yeah, it's a very good, like, problem solving.
Like, if you take
basic problem
this
solving
number from this side of the equation to that side of the equation, it becomes a minus. These are important things because it teaches people that maths is a process, that there are things that you need to understand about multiplication, division, subtraction, addition. And times tables are obviously massively important, but those you can, those people pull out their calculator for these days. Mm. I don't know that those are as important.
So yeah,
I'm kind of at odds with the guy, I have to say.
Yeah, it's quite difficult considering a lot of people's first reaction is going to be, you're a maths and science teacher. You have no place talking about whether Shakespeare should exist in a syllabus or not when you work with times tables all day. Mm. The other thing
that
is...
That wasn't my criticism, but yeah.
The English major in me, the hair stands up on the back of my neck when I hear him saying that, uh-huh. because that was the basis of my education for so long.
And look how you turned out. Yeah. Well-rounded and yeah, interesting.
Exactly. Check what I'm like.
Just check what
check
I'm
what
like.
Check what I'm like. Correct.
Check what I'm like.
Okay, yeah.
But then you think, if people aren't getting the basics like times tables, if they're not getting just the basics, then maybe other things should fall away so that we can get people on the basics just so that they can survive.
Yeah, I find that the problem when I'm interviewing prospective job candidates, and we get emails every single week here. I'm sure every employer in South Africa does, because there are more people out there who are looking for jobs than there are jobs for people who want them, right? I'm not really interested in what qualification they have. I'm interested in whether or not they can hold a conversation, whether they've got character, whether they've got values. And they have to have a comprehensive idea of how the world works. And unless you have things like Shakespeare, and I mean, I'm not going to give them a Shakespeare test, but if I refer to something that is fairly obvious, let me think of a good example here. It came up the other day in a conversation with Anthony Medera. We were recording Blind History, and we spoke about... Bottom from, was it Twelfth Night?
Yes, I think so.
I think it was Twelfth Night. Anyway, just how you have this person who is a, they're a bumbling fool who's there for the enjoyment and the ridicule. They're the comic relief in a situation. And everyone in their office always has someone who's the bottom in their office, right? The comic relief in their office.
Yeah, Baldrick and Blackadder.
Correct. So if you don't have any idea of who Bottom was in Twelfth Night or
Midsummer Night's Dream.
I thought so. Shit. Midsummer Night's Dream. Anyway, then you don't understand that the character represents a whole thing about humanity that
exactly.
needs distillation and explanation. And who has the time to explain that stuff to me?
Like, who's going to tell you were just cuckolded?
Exactly.
Shakespeare will tell you what that's about. Right. And therefore, you know not to be cuckolded again.
So there's a reason that this stuff was put into the syllabus in the first place. And I think while William Smith's quite right, there's probably a lot of stuff that can be taken out. That's not the stuff that you should be taking out. I think those are the things that precisely the things that people do not have in society. I don't need more people who understand, let's just say... political concepts, social media wokeness. Don't need more of those people. What you need is people who actually do have a deep understanding of Shakespeare, or of Western philosophy, or of even Eastern philosophy, of characters in history that have made terrible mistakes and why they made those mistakes. It gives you a general idea of like where we're at. Mm-hmm. This is why I keep telling people to read Yuval Noah Harari, and why he's such a huge thing at the moment, because people are hungry for this. They don't get taught this at school anymore. And as a result, they need to know where we fit into the long story of humanity.
Correct.
And it's fascinating once you do discover it. It just leads you down a path of discovery that will only improve you as a human being. But that's besides the point. I don't want to get too carried away. Bernie Bernard Sanders was at a town hall the other day, and he brought up Martin Luther King and got booed. Again, this is about the ignorance of humanity, right? Bernie talks to very woke people on the very far left of the spectrum. These are the people he's going for in the vote if he's to win the primary for the Democratic nomination for president.
Mm-hmm.
But because they've moved so far to the left, Martin Luther King is now an enemy. You know what he said? What was the most famous thing Martin Luther King said. He said, I have a dream, and do you know where it goes? Here's where it ends. This is the important part of that speech. He says, one day my children will be judged not by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. Right?
Mm.
Big. Mm-hmm. Million people on the mall in Washington at the Lincoln Memorial. Big deal. Big historical moment where he said, your race should not matter and you should not be discriminated against based on your race.
And that applies to white people too, white people.
That's correct. It applies to everyone. That's why Martin Luther King remains and should always remain a hero in the human story. But what's happened? The woke left have moved so far off the reserve that now it is not acceptable for you to say that people should be judged on the content of their character. No, by their methods and by their evaluation, if you are black, then certain things apply, and if you are white, certain things do not apply. And this is the way that they think the world is. And if you're, for example, in a minority, or you're a trans person, or you're gay, or you're in a wheelchair, then there's a whole bunch of other stuff that applies to you. It's what we call the intersectional hierarchy. The intersectional victim hierarchy. This has supplanted what Martin Luther King said. I want to be able to talk to you without knowing whether you're black, female, transsexual, in a wheelchair, or any other kind of thing. Maybe you're American Indian, maybe you've got a drug problem. I don't want to know. But if you and I are exchanging ideas, I'm going to judge you based on your ideas. The left don't like that anymore. So here's Bernie. He's talking about Martin Luther King. And by the way, Bernie was a supporter of Martin Luther King's. I think he was even on the march with Martin Luther King.
He had nothing else to do. He's never had a job.
Well, that's right. But he's so old that he was actually there in Washington when the Million Man March happened. And let's hear what he says here. And people boo him for bringing up Martin Luther King as if Martin Luther King was a bad person.
To fight against the rise of white nationalism and white terrorist acts. And how do you plan to lead on that in your first year as president?
We have got to make it very clear that the type of demagoguery we are seeing from the Trump administration is not what this country is about. And I will do everything that I can to help lead this country in a direction that ends all forms of discrimination.
The core of the question is about, as president, what would you do with the rise of white supremacist violence to protect our communities?
Absolutely. You know, as somebody who I know I date myself a little bit here, but I actually was at the March on Washington with Dr. King back in 1963. And as somebody who actively supported Jesse Jackson's campaign as one of the few white elected officials to do so in 88, I have dedicated my life to the fight against racism and sexism and discrimination of all forms.
Now, okay, why did he get booed there? I need to understand this. What kind of a thing is this where someone like Bernie Sanders gets booed for bringing up Martin Luther King Jr.? This to me is extraordinary. Huh?
I'm also trying to work it out. If he said Jesse Smollett, would he have been cheered?
Oh, yes, probably. Because that's the intersectional victim hierarchy that we were talking about earlier.
I can't believe how much fight he's got in him at the age of 77.
Well, yeah, he's a very...
he looks an old 77, eh?
Yeah, he does. He looks like an 87-year-old, 77-year-old.
Feisty old bastard, this guy. Yeah. All right, so listen, we're going to talk in a moment or two to someone who I've been meaning to speak to for a long time, Dr. Marlena Kruger, who's a technology addiction expert. We'll get to her in a second. But we've got to bring up something that I think everybody was talking about last week and we didn't get a chance to discuss it. Mr. South Africa.
Yes.
Can we just...
It's an annual event.
Yeah, can we pause for a minute and just talk about Mr. South Africa? All right.
If you haven't seen this, go onto the Gareth Cliff Show page on Instagram.
Right.
You'll see the list.
Right. And you'll see the list of guys, and there's a mugshot of all of them. I say it's a mugshot because that's what it looks like.
It looks like one. The lighting's bad.
Holy
their expressions are bad.
This is bad. So if you thought that Mr. South Africa was going to be a lineup of really hot-looking guys representing the best in male virility and strength and power and the kind of guy that any girl would want, well, are you in for a surprise? These guys look like they all have been on tick for the most of their lives. and are terribly genetically disabled.
Oh, my word.
These are like the worst looking people you've ever
seen. Please
tell
me they're just bad photographs.
They look like they're from The Walking Dead. There's no other way for me to put it.
Well,
those are the Mr. South Africa finalists. Do me a favor.
They are not representative of South Africans, the general South African male, because they're competition enterers.
But they're horrible looking people. If you're going to enter a competition.
Okay, I've got to come out of the side of Mr. South Africa here, because okay. There has to be someone. Okay, so JP Roberts is the CEO of Mr. South Africa.
What did he say?
Also a male model. And he said, it isn't about models. Anybody can enter this.
Oh,
it's about doing more
problem.
For society.
Oh, bullshit. We're not looking for social workers. We're looking for Mr. South Africa. You think Miss South Africa? I don't know what's in her head. I want her to look pretty.
One of the biggest things that Mr. South Africa is focusing on is child welfare and supporting the SPCA. And they want people who are just good people.
Oh, come on.
Okay, no, cool. No, have that say, and that's great. But this is my big problem here. The photos are fucking horrific. Like you say, when you take a bad photo, these look like... Last week, I went to Postnet for a visa. I took a passport photo, right? And I look shit most days. Bedraggled is actually a nice word I could probably use for myself. I look better than these mugshots here. This is just... It's unprofessional. These pictures are terrible, and they're put into this horrible gold, which is kind of like burnt brown, which then dulls everyone's features down. Horrific pictures. And that's all it really comes down to. And because the dimensions are even squished, some of their faces look like their mothers have been drinking since their grandmother's time. So it's just really, really poor photography,
yeah,
I would say.
They've elongated the photographs.
Yes.
So it's made their faces like thinner.
And that makes you look unsavory at best, I've got to say. But Mr. South Africa is all about having good, solid people of the community rather than a looks contest.
Yeah, well, if you're going to do that, then don't call it Mr. South Africa. Because Mr. South Africa means beauty pageant. That's what it means. And Miss South Africa means beauty pageant. And all these people who run these pageants, like the people who took over Miss America after Donald Trump gave it up, or Miss USA, I don't know what the difference is between the two. What you don't realize is nobody's watching it because they want to hear what's in the heads of these people. Otherwise, you'd walk out into the street and just grab someone off the street and ask them what they thought about things. Nobody wants to do that.
I totally agree with you, Gareth. You should be upfront and say the Mr. Beautiful whatever.
Yes.
We must find the country's most beautiful person.
Right.
I don't care if they drool when they try speak.
Yeah.
Let's actually just find the most beautiful person. And then create another shitstorm around that because people will say you can't objectify people.
There are enough other fora in the world for people who have great ideas or want to be philanthropists or want to help their children. There are lots of places, most of them in social work. It's not very glamorous, but those are the places where you make the difference. And if people want to do that stuff, then that's what you do. You want to enter Mr. South Africa, look like something.
Hey,
and if you look like these people... Do not ever cross my path again.
Poor photography, but also if they're doing it just so they can get a bit of a gobby in Boxburg on a Friday night, then good to them
sure,
as well.
That's fine too.
Everyone's got a motive.
Sure. And I mean, we know, like Leanne says, there are professional competition enterers. There are people who do this because that's what they've done. Their parents told them that they were pretty when they were 3, and of course they've aged badly, but they still want to win something because their parents said that was important. And therefore, they enter these competitions. And that's why you've got a Miss Clarence and a Mr. Boxburg and a Miss Kempton Park. And God forbid what other parts of the country should produce these pageants. But they do. And the singular most important thing about a pageant is?
Your looks.
Thank you. So let's not confuse ourselves. Let's not lie to the children. Let's tell these people that they must all go back to the drawing board, get a lot of plastic surgery. In some cases, they'll have to do way worse things than plastic surgery to get into this list. Sorry.
Well, Mr. South Africa on Twitter said, "We never said you need to be sexy to be Mr. South Africa."
So they're admitting they're ugly.
All we ask is dedication to a better essay and a good heart.
Well,
if that's not good enough
for
our country, then we don't know what else to give you.
Run for president then. Don't run for Mr. South Africa. That's ridiculous. I mean, next thing you know, some 200-kilogram fatso is going to enter, and then they're going to walk around in a Speedo and subject us all to the pain and ignominy of that. Come on. Awful.
Look, I also think, Gareth, it's a reflection on how savage society is. These guys are all trying their hardest. They've got good hearts, apparently.
Shame. I'm so sorry that you're trying so hard and nobody thinks you're pretty when you look like the back end of a bus. It's a beauty pageant. If we wanted to know how good a person you were, we'd have Mr. or Miss Virtue Signal 2019.
That would be a good pageant.
Then you can get out there and tell us how great you, how much you care about everybody else, and how you fought some nasty troll on Twitter, and you're so brave.
There's actually a really good show waiting to happen. Just you're a pageant show. Every episode is a new pageant.
Yeah, Mr. and Miss Virtue Signal 2019. Let's do that. All right, I want to bring, because this is such a valid moment to bring in someone called Dr. Marlena Kruger, who is a technology addiction expert. How much time do you spend on your phone? I mean, this is fascinating, right?
I spent 2 hours and 20 minutes last week.
Do you think that you'd be able to spend less time on your phone if you put your mind to it? Or are you starting to feel anxiety at the mere thought of this? I was driving down to this family thing in the Free State, and my phone was running out of battery. Now, I'm not addicted to my phone. I'm on it a lot, but I don't think I'm addicted. I don't think so. I mean, I might be. But just seeing the battery die on this thing made me nervous and uncomfortable. So I need to talk to someone who knows how to explain these things to me. Technology has, of course, become one of the greatest aspects of living in the 21st century. It's also brought about the idea of not being able to deny that we're so deeply immersed in this tech-driven world that we immediately and lastingly get anxious and desperate if we lose our connection to the internet or our devices stop working. A smartphone is not just a tool in the hands of anybody making it supposedly easier to live. It's also an object for triggering biochemical reactions in our brains, feeding obsessions and addictions, and potentially making our quality of life poorer, not better. Let's talk about how addicted we are to technology, the good and the bad. Dr. Marlena Kruger is a technology addiction expert. She's the founder of the Techno Life Wise Foundation and will be giving a talk about the neuroscientific power of clicks at the upcoming SACAP Festival of Learning, which is on the 30th and 31st of May in Johannesburg. So what a pleasure to meet you, Dr. Kruger. Thank you so much for coming to join us this morning.
It's a pleasure for me to be here. It's a privilege, I think, first time around. But so thank you very much for the opportunity and greetings to everyone.
Now, you studied this. This was not a field of study before.
Yeah.
Because obviously we're getting into it now, 10, maybe 15 years of experiencing this world. We don't know what the long-term effects are. What have you already picked up in terms of the trends? And whether or not most of us, whether we think we are or not, are addicted to our phones.
Yes, I think, as you say, it is new to all of us. So we're part of the experiment in the bigger world as well. I think, on the other hand, we have the opportunity to learn from the world where they have been, 5 to 10 years, depending on how you would define it or describe it, regarding to access to technology and how much easier for the Americas of this world.
So they're ahead of us a little bit.
Yeah. So we can learn from them. Right. And I think from that point of view, that's where I've learned. And my background is the neuroscientific education field. I've worked in whole brain learning, whole person development, so the holistic approach to personal development and learning. And I've been very active in the rollout and use of technology in teaching and learning environments at the University of Johannesburg, for instance, CTI Education Group later on, and actively involved with getting more technology in the teaching and learning space, and we're definitely convinced that it's adding much more value to the engagement and the interaction and the way that we are learning. But when we rolled out tablets to the students on the different campuses nationally, and I did the interviews with lecturers and students, I actually realized that it is actually most probably more addiction and interruption and distraction for the students, more to the other side of engagement with the learning materials.
So in other words, that while there are all these positive advantages, and I don't think anyone will dispute that we have access to information that's never been available before, that everybody's connected, that this allows you to share ideas and to learn new things and to do so at a rate that was unbelievable to just one generation ago, that actually the presence of this technology in the classroom disengages people from the material.
Yes, that's our experience, okay. You know, because it has been designed to distract us, to interrupt us. It is actually to keep us there. And it's great when it's helping us. And as you say, we don't deny that. But I think the importance is to really go more critical about it and realize that it's a medium. It's only a tool. It's not the one and only tool in this world. And we need to stay human and we need to develop everything that make the difference between us and the robots and the artificial virtual world.
So how do we do that? I mean, what is the stuff that you tell people to start being aware of? How do you get people to disengage from the platforms and the technology and to actually start being human again?
Yeah, I think it's a process, as it has been a process, and it's a process the way that we engage with technology, and it's helping us a lot. So I think I promote and encourage people to think more critically about what's the differences for us being human. So our senses, our top-to-toe brain and neural networks that need to be stimulated in the way that we were created. Mm-hmm. In other words, if we are not developing and engaging everything as human beings, we are actually like the muscles of the world. We are losing the possibilities and the functionalities. So my encouragement is really from babies to older age, that when we engage with technology, be critical about it, make sure it's helping us, it's adding value, it's adding quality, and don't waste your time, if I can put it that way, because there's a balance.
Yeah, everybody knows when they're wasting time. It's like when you've gone onto, for example, Instagram, and you find yourself just scrolling and scrolling and scrolling for, and 10 minutes go past, and then 15 minutes, and before you know it, it's an hour. Mm. And that's just wasted time. You've gathered nothing useful from that exercise, and you've put nothing out that's productive, right?
Yes, and I think that is definitely, you know, it's so easy to think that you relax or that is adding value. Mm. But if it's not with a specific purpose that you want to search for this or that, and you go on and you limit yourself, because, I mean, the world is there. You can be hours online, and as you say, then you haven't actually adding value to what you were looking for. So it's really about being more critically, be more human, make sure that our neuroscientific networks are developing in the way that it has been created and not flattened like the screens.
So yeah, that's a good point. But how do you observe the differences between, say, toddlers and then adolescents and then adults in terms of the way that they use technology? Are there differences, and what have you picked up?
Yes, unfortunately, it is actually very sad if you think of the babies and the toddlers, because if they are engaging and getting too much screen time, they are underdeveloping, and they have weaker development and milestones that they are reaching and achieving, like even language development, like the physical development, like the emotional and social development, because they are linked to the screens. And because it's so addicted, they are screaming, and you have little war zones when you take away the screens, because they are actually being mesmerized by all the activities in front of the screen. So it's a bombardment, it's overwhelming them. And then they don't actually want to connect with the real world. And you are getting very bored because you're not so excited.
So that's for toddlers, but I mean adolescents and even young adults, I hear reports coming out every now and then about people of that age group who are unable to form meaningful relationships with anybody. They are so nervous and anxious around actual people in a situation where they aren't separated by a screen that they find themselves unable to engage in any meaningful way, that they find everything about the world intimidating because it's not from the safety of a screen, and that these people are effectively going to walk out into the world like marshmallows with no ability to deal with reality. Is that what you found?
Yes, unfortunately.
Oh my God. I was hoping you'd say no and you'll be able to go home.
No, unfortunately, that is the reports that's coming out, that we are already seeing that, that, well, I mean, the negative aspects, we are also aware of them, say, the increase in the rate of suicides.
Mm.
And the, really, teenagers who can't cope with this world, as you are saying, in the real human sense.
Yes.
They are comfortable behind the screens.
If someone walked up to them and spoke to them, they wouldn't know what to do.
Yes, and I think the employers will also already be able to tell you, they see the differences in the people in front of them supposed to work, be productive, and how they are actually distracted by the technology, because they will have and think that they must have, and they are more productive with many screens in front of them, all their cell phones next to them, and actually it's cutting through all of us, because we are best if we are focusing and we are ticking and do what we need to do and get on to the next job. So we need a much more disciplined environment for staying human, being the best that we can, and making sure that we are contributing to society and not only absorbing and being overwhelmed by the wonderful world of technology.
But that's the whole problem with is discipline. Yes. Are you going to be the parent who goes against what the rest of the people are doing, and the rest of the children, the age of your children, and say, you can only do this for 1 hour a day? Are parents doing that even?
Yeah, I think that's definitely where our challenges are, because surely that's not the most popular thing to say.
That's right, yeah.
But luckily, there are already parents and people out there as well that are supporting the notion that we must be much more careful and much more critical about the number of hours that we say it's okay for us and or our children to engage and be in front of screens, because we know that it's not adding value. After 1 to 2 hours, there's a study that came out that the more hours you are spending on your screen, the more you are most probably going to be anxious, to be depressed, to be suicidal later on, because it's a fake environment that you think you have many friends, for instance, but at the end of the day, it's actually stealing your life, and it's not contributing to living your life and enjoying your life in the real world.
And it's not only teenagers that it happens to. Mm-hmm. I mean, I have an app that tells me how many hours per day on average I'm spending on my phone alone. And that's 6 hours of screen time.
Wow.
And then I still have my laptop. Gosh. And there's still TV.
Oh. Yeah.
That, I mean, and I'm in my 40s. It's not, it can affect anyone at any age, really.
Yes. Yes. And I think that's why it's so important that we are raising the awareness and promoting this more critical decision-making process.
Another area parents have to be on tenterhooks, effectively.
And are the parents themselves living up to the example? Because if I was a parent, how would I tell my child that when I spend 6 hours on my phone a day?
Exactly.
Look, it's because of my job too.
No, but you know that that's
the numbers
also
are the
partly
numbers.
An excuse. I mean, I don't. For example, I don't get email on my phone, just as one other way to reduce the amount of time I spend on it. But all these apps, I mean, I've cut 2/3 of the apps that I used to be on. Just so that I don't spend so much time on it. And honestly, your life improves. You find you're listening to people when they talk. You find you're paying attention in meetings. I mean, there are people who sit in meetings and their phone is sitting right next to them. And it goes off in the middle of the meeting. And you can see they drift off and they look at their phone and they stop talking to you.
And they're gone.
Yeah. And you're like, well, what was the point of you driving all this way to have this meeting if you're going to be on your phone?
Mm. Yeah. And I think it's wonderful if you can already confirm what's the differences by making small changes and being actually experiencing the difference in your quality of life.
You don't need Facebook on your phone. You don't need Twitter on your phone. You don't need these things.
So you're saying keep them on your laptop and
I mean, I'll go
watch your time.
I go onto Twitter on the web when I'm looking for news, or I'm looking because I'm only following a few people and I'm not really interested in what people are saying to me. because it's not a real platform for communication. It's shouting at each other. And even though there are people who occasionally will make very valuable contributions, they're in the minority. So why devote so much time to it, right? Email is usually for business. So I need to do that. But I'm only doing that on a laptop where I can sit down, focus. It's not something you can do while you're in the queue at Home Affairs or while you're in the shopping mall or while you're sitting down to lunch with a friend, because then you're not paying attention to the friend.
Yes, and it's wonderful to hear all these realities already. You also have observed it and made changes to it. And I think that is really the parents that need to become more critical, be the role models, put the discipline there, because short term, we may think, but we need it. Or the children need it, because that's actually what the marketing guys would also tell you.
That's the message, yeah.
Yeah. If you are not with it, you will lose out.
And be on the whole time.
Yeah, and you will lose your life, and that's the future. But it's really, we are going to lose humanity if we're not being more critical about staying human and get less engagement, so that we are getting the balance. And each one of us will have another balance, and each one will have to make wise choices on a daily basis. I mean, that's part of what I'm saying, a holistic and multimodal approach that I help and that I've said. It's a techno-life balance or a techno-life wellness. So I've said work-life balance is kind of out of the window, because work, you can work everywhere and 24 hours
thanks
a day.
Thanks to technology, it goes home with you whether you like it or not. Yeah,
yeah, whether we like it or not. So it's now a techno-life. So I call it a techno-life balance and wellness and looking after our health, because it does have an impact from
brain hormones.
Top to toe. Yeah. I mean, it's physically, it's emotionally, it's socially, it's spiritually. It's having an impact on each and every area of our lives. And therefore, we should not taking it or put it in isolation when we focus on one aspect, the social aspect or the physical aspect, because we must realize it does have an impact on every aspect of our lives.
Can I quickly go back to the addiction thing, because this is something that I particularly wanted you to address, Dr. Kruger, because this is your area of expertise. So when we talk about addiction, addiction is behavior which starts to harm. So it's repeating behavior. It's doing things for a reason that you maybe get the right stimulation and it makes you happy and it gives you some kind of a high or it gives you some kind of a reward response in your brain. When do you know that you're addicted, because there has to be an element of this that is starting to harm? It's starting to do something that is not good to either you or the people around you. How do you know when you've crossed that threshold with technology?
Yeah, I think it's you will get a continuum of addiction, as we put it. But I think the moment that you are preferring your screen engagement
over
the human engagement, you know, if you prefer and you are more attached to the likes on your Facebook and the approval in the virtual environment or the screen environment versus having a good relationship with someone in the real world, you know. So the moment that you are actually detaching yourself a little bit from the real world and prefer the virtual world in whatever way it would be, and you are getting upset if the screens are away or if the internet is off, you know, because surely it's uncomfortable, yes, but we should be able to be okay with it, you know.
And would you classify gaming in all of this as well?
Yes, unfortunately, yes, definitely, because that's most probably one of the bigger addictions, because it's so rushed. You know, it's really pushing us almost over the limits, if I can put it that way. And the more we engage, the more we want. And so that is actually the cycle of addiction then, you know. And later on, you actually don't have all the hormones left, because you have just done
spent them all on shooting fake prostitutes and killing policemen.
Yes, and it sounds very exciting, and it is. I mean, therefore, there are so many people engaging in that. Mm. But it's really to get that balance and be connected with the real world and be critical about, yes, it is adding value, but most of the times, if we need to choose, is it be critical about, is it adding value to my real life or to my virtual life? And if you prefer adding value to your virtual life, you must start thinking very critically about it, because most of the time it will be second best, because the screens are flat, if I can put it that way.
Mm, literally,
and,
yeah.
Yeah, and your productivity, your relationships, your learning, your development will actually be flattened like the screens, because think of the depth of who you are and the three-dimensional world of where we are living in. And it's much more richer than a flat screen that is only a picture of the real world, you know. So we can make those choices, and we just need to get more people involved and getting momentum, so that the people who are thinking this way and becoming more critical about humanity and stay human, so that we won't be replaced. Because if we are as flat as the screens and as flat as the robots,
a machine can do it. Yeah.
Then the machine can do it. But
what
if,
use are you?
But if we stay human and we are adding value, real critical value and problem-solving skills and being human, all those capabilities, then we won't be replaced. And we will still enjoy the world and be excited about the world with technology, but only when it's helping us and not enslaved us, because it's already enslaving many of us. And yes,
it's breaking down that important human element. All right, so Dr. Marlene Kruger, we're going to speak in a moment about the SACAP Festival of Learning, but I do have to remind you that there is a great new episode of Naked Insurance's Naked Economy out today. What happens when a young, inexperienced doctor working in rural Swaziland gets a patient he can't help? He invents a solution, of course. You can find out more about Dr. William Mapham's inspiring story on the Naked Economy. It's brought to you by Naked Insurance. Go to cliffcentral.com or on our app, any other app if you like it. Get your podcasts wherever you like to get them. And listen to the new episode of The Naked Economy, and you'll find an inspiring and fascinating story there, too. So, Dr. Kruger, tell me, this SACAP Festival of Learning, you're going to be doing a talk on the neuroscientific power of clicks. When is this happening? It's 30 to 31 May, right?
Yes. That's 2 days in Johannesburg. It's actually on the Thursday evening and then on the Friday, the full day. And the previous week on the 23rd and 24th in Cape Town. The one in Johannesburg will be hosted on the campus, the SACAP campus in Rosebank, and the times 5:30 in the evening till 8 o'clock on the Thursday evening, and then from 9 till 5 on the Friday. So we are very excited about. I think it's lovely to call it the Festival of Learning, because we are learning every day, whether it's formal or informal, and education that's a way to change behaviors, and therefore it's will provide a great opportunity. I'm very excited about the fact that it specifically my talk will also add to CPD or continuous professional development points, because I think that is helping other people to get on the bus, and as you say, to go a little bit against the flow. But I think the more people becoming aware, the more people will be joining in. The moment that they are understanding the bigger picture of the impact, the neuroscientific impact on us from top to toe, I think, and that's what I have experienced up until now, people are starting to think more critically, and they may be able to change behaviors
and maybe influence other people to change their behaviors too.
I trust that will happen.
Well, you can meet Dr. Marlene Kruger, and you can also hear what she has to say that she's only really touched on today for us. The 25-year career that she spent playing a variety of roles in tertiary education, and most especially now about the addiction to technology. Dr. Marlene Kruger, thank you so much for joining us this morning.
Thank you very much for the great opportunity.
Sure. We're going to finish up with the unnews for this morning and let you know what's going on in the headlines. Don't forget a fresh new episode of Auto Central. I can see Tyron's here. He's getting ready. George Meany, the rest of the crew from Auto Trader will pop by to let
you
know.
Is that Tyron or is that a Mr. South Africa contestant?
It's definitely Tyron. And by the way, speaking of...
giving us the middle finger.
Speaking of the Mr. South Africa contestants, Mr. Schmangel says this morning, "Hey dudes and dudette, I thought that I was an ugly guy when I was sober. Hauntsome when I'm high and drunk, but... Hauntsome, handsome. But until I saw the entrance to the Mr. South Africa bullshit, wow, what happened to all the beautiful people out there? Holy shit, that's Mr. Schmangels.
They got jobs with their looks. They got jobs they weren't qualified for their looks. They don't need to be in a Mr. SA.
Okay. I want to see those people's philanthropy CVs, and I bet you they're also crap. Just saying. Maybe they picked up litter once or helped a granny across the street, but I don't think that they are saving the world several hundred people at a time. I really fail to understand that that's the reason that we suddenly are interested in these people. And the rest of South Africa went brutal on them. If you want to follow that, it's all over social media.
Brutal, yeah.
Brutal is the word. All right, so we're wrapping it up. That's all we've got for you today. I know Leanne wanted to get to male model deaths and all the rest of it.
We'll do that tomorrow.
We've got time tomorrow.
And in summary, for why Shakespeare is important in our times,
right?
This was an answer from a published poet in creative writing, poetry. He said, "Shakespeare is important for the following reasons. He lists a few, starting with he wrote beautifully and speaking about paint and art, but he finishes off with he had a profound understanding of us as human beings, what we think, what we feel, and how we act. And that'll never change throughout time."
Beautiful. There we go. Leanne, putting it into better words than me. Julius Malema continues to promise amazing things to people if they vote for the EFF. Musi Maimane is considering doing the same to attract votes to the DA, but Patricia de Lille used up all the DA's lies back when she promised rain in the Cape, so now they don't have anything. Ford is currently under a criminal investigation in the USA around their emission claims, but locally the manufacturer is still feeling the backlash of exploding cougars. The cougar is more dangerous now than ever, even more so than those teachers in America who prey on young boys. And finally, Rassie Erasmus is sweating over the injuries of the key Springbok players. He's also sweating over a breakfast he just had at Wimpy. Lesson learned there is never trust a sausage in the AM. You would think Rassie would know this by now. All right, that's all we got for today. We will see you tomorrow between 6 and 9. Don't forget, Auto Central coming up, cliffcentral.com, and a whole lot.
This is CliffCentral.com.